You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of A Different World by Leah Fay Cooper. Hardison, me, Dawn, Marissa, and Lisa shot the credits one weekend, which were amazing, but there was no Whitley, and we didn't even know there was going to be a Whitley. We got to work for the first table read on Monday, and Jasmine had just finished auditioning 20 minutes beforehand. They brought her right down, and I was like, oh, snap, that's my homie. Sinbad, Walter Oakes, I heard they were looking for a stand-up comic to warm up the studio audience, so I met with the producers, and Bill Cosby was there. I lied so much. They asked me if I'd done stand-up for a studio audience before, and I said, yes, for Magnum P.I. They said, Magnum P.I. didn't have a studio audience. Cosby offered Sinbad the stand-up role anyway, and a guest spot on The Cosby Show. After that appearance, he was cast in A Different World. Lewis, we kept parts of the episodes that we had already shot, and then shot new scenes that had got melded in so that the whole cast would appear from the very first episode. Hardison, I thought, this thing might run 6 or 8 weeks, then they'll cancel it, and then I can go on to being a movie star, which is what I wanted to be. I thought of myself as a film actor. Belle appeared for the first time in Episode 4 as an unnamed student. Belle, my character was talking to Whitley, and he had to turn to her and say, I knew it could be done. When it came time for me to say it, I tried to stretch that line out as long as I could. They were like, okay, my man, do you want to shorten that up? Bowser, it wasn't the best line reading, but we loved him, and we're like, we've got to find something for Daryl to do. Soon after, Belle accepted an offer to be Keisha Knight Pulliam's stand-in for an episode she was appearing in. Because minors could work only a limited number of hours, she wasn't allowed to attend all of the rehearsals. In the episode, Rudy Huxtable visits Denise at Hillman and becomes enamored with Whitley. Belle, they got me some hockey pads so I could get on my knees and be Rudy's size for the camera, and Rudy had adopted Whitley's accent, so I spent the entire week playing an 8-year-old girl with a southern accent, climbing into bed with Jasmine Guy and Lisa Bonet. Everyone thought it was so funny. Lena Waithe, writer, producer, and actor. My earliest memory of A Different World is it being used as a punishment. That's how serious it was. If I didn't do well on a test or if I got in trouble at school, I remember my mom saying, you ain't going to be able to watch A Different World if you keep acting up. Bonet, who was not available to comment for this story, married musician Lenny Kravitz on her 20th birthday, November 16, 1987, and announced her pregnancy the following May. Though some advocated for the pregnancy to be written into the show, a scenario that many young women could relate to, it's been widely reported that Cosby and others disagreed. Bonet subsequently left A Different World, but rejoined The Cosby Show after the birth of her daughter, Zoe. Belle, Lisa doesn't get enough credit for A Different World. It was all because of her popularity that Mr. Cosby had the idea to do this spinoff. And I know it was a lot of pressure, particularly when she and Lenny started dating. The amount of press and paparazzi that hounded and followed them, they were 20-year-old kids. Anyone who has suggested that Lisa was unprofessional or difficult to work with, it's just not true. Guy, I felt like Lisa was diminished in her ability to look natural. Everybody said, well, that's just her. Do you know how hard it is to make your reality truth in front of a camera? Lewis, the creators wanted to go in a different direction culturally, which meant Marissa was also gone. She and Lisa are incredible women, and they were so much fun to work with. It was sad for me because we had started this journey together, for them to not be there anymore. Loretta Devine, Stevie Rallon. One day I came to work and my whole apartment was gone. It was just a door. That was sort of a clue that my character wasn't coming back. It was one of the tragedies of my career. I was devastated. I thought everything was just over. Guy, Kadeem and I were like, are we coming back next season? Because people were getting fired a lot. It was a very tumultuous time. We never knew who was going to leave or why. While A Different World finished its first season rated number 2 behind The Cosby Show, the writers and cast believed that the story should more accurately portray student life at an HBCU. Debbie Allen, director and executive producer, my sister, Felicia Rashad, was a guest on A Different World, and she observed some problems behind the scenes in terms of the storytelling. I think she had a conversation with Mr. Cosby, and then he had conversations with producers Marcy Carsey, Tom Werner, and Karen Mandebach. They decided they needed a voice that understood historically black colleges. I went to Howard University, and it was everything in my growth and my self-discovery, from young teenager to woman. Bowser, there was a real opportunity between seasons 1 and 2 to do the show that we knew A Different World needed to be. Bowser, Fales Hill, and fellow writer Thad Mumford went on an HBCU tour, visiting students at Spelman, Morehouse, Howard, and other HBCUs to talk to them about college life. Allen, I had been asked to work on Family Ties, but then I got this call from Bill, and he said, you know, we need you to come and get out your broom, clean it up, and bring reality to it. So that's what I did. I made that choice. Fales Hill, it was in our second season with Debbie as our director and executive producer that we really started to find our own voice. Cree Summer, Freddie Brooks. The girl that was my competition lived in England, and Debbie asked if she could stay with me. So I had my competition sleeping on my couch, and the two of us drove to NBC together. I remember Kadeem walked by, and I thought, oh, God, he is so effing fine. Fales Hill, we created Freddie's character after a trip to Spelman and Morehouse. Several students ask us, why don't we see anybody who's from a mixed marriage on your show? I'm from a mixed marriage myself, but I didn't think people wanted to talk about that or see it. I was fascinated. Alan, one of the first things I did was take everybody's fake nails and hair weaves off to make them a little more natural, and we had to put hot sauce on the tables. Administratively, a lot of barriers came down. This was a time when it was perceived that the writers were gods and the actors should just do what they're told. But any show that works is a real collaboration. Bill, when Debbie came on board, after every rehearsal, we'd have a note session with the writers and producers, and we could talk to them about what we liked and didn't like. Then they would make changes and come back to us. So it wasn't us versus them. It was us together. Hardison, all of a sudden the show got real. Then it became amazing. The change was night and day. Under Allen's leadership, A Different World remained comedic, but no topic was off limits. Rape, racism, AIDS, and colorism were all among issues the show explored. Fales Hill, I was able to share something that a lot of people didn't know, which is that there were black people in America who owned slaves, particularly in Louisiana. That was an episode that dealt with colorism, and I remember after our first table reading, we had a 2-hour conversation, because everyone had their own story of being otherized because of the color of their skin, whether it was considered too light or too dark or whatever. It was one of those moments where we knew we really hit the mother lode because it ran so deep. Alan, if there's an episode that was remarkable, it was the AIDS episode. It's remarkable that it even got on the air. We were under a microscope. I don't think the network wanted us to do it, and advertisers pulled out, but it was just the time. I got Whoopi Goldberg to play a teacher, and I knew she was going to win the Academy Award that year for Ghost, and she was amazing. Tisha Campbell played the young girl who had been infected with AIDS, which was also the first role on the show Jada Pinkett auditioned for. Hardison, the number one episode for me is easily Cats in the Cradle, when Dwayne and Ron go to a football game, and these white dudes spray-painted the N-word on Ron's car. Then they got into a fight with them, and they all got thrown into jail together. It was so well written, and it was all about listening to each other. Wathe, an episode that I don't think gets talked about enough, is when Jada Pinkett Smith's character, Lena's father, comes back into her life. She's in a writing class, and she writes a story about her dad that isn't true. He shows up, and he's not the guy that she wrote about. It examines the relationship between black fathers and their daughters, and how sometimes black fathers have demons that, unfortunately, their children have to deal with. Summer, Debbie was always so ahead of her time. Date rape had just been defined in the culture. We had just named it, and it had been happening all over campuses. I remember feeling very empowered that we were going to be brave enough to talk about it. And I love that episode so much because of the healthy, platonic relationship between Dwayne and Freddie. And that was a wonderful thing about A Different World. A lot of the platonic friendships were so healthy. Fales Hill, after the date rape episode, we got a call from the Attorney General of Pennsylvania. There was a little girl who had been raped by her neighbor while selling Girl Scout cookies. She was 7 years old, and she didn't tell her parents. 6 months later, she saw the episode, and it gave her the language to understand what had happened to her. They brought the case to the prosecutor. When you're writing for TV, there are a lot of moments where you say, "What am I going to do with my life? There are so many problems in the world, and I'm not solving them." But moments like that made you realize there's something that you can do. Emil Wilbekin, journalist and founder of Platform, an advocacy group for black, gay, and queer men, Native Son. The show premiered when I was a sophomore at Hampton University. In many ways, A Different World helped a lot of us who were in college, or just out of college, process what was going on in the world. It was a safe space for us, and in some ways created a form of therapy. We were seeing ourselves portrayed in a positive way, but also in a very thoughtful human way, and dealing with a lot of trauma that we were dealing with in our real lives. Glenn Turman, Colonel Taylor. Here's how influential Colonel Taylor was. I was driving down the street one day, in the hood, so to speak, and I saw two young men, teenagers, in a brawl. Something told me to stop and go over, so I did. I stood there and said, "Look at me. You stop this. Both of you, stop this." They looked and they said, "My God, it's Colonel Taylor." And they stopped. Wathe, there's definitely talk about we only want to see happy black people, or we don't want to see trauma in our entertainment. But the truth is, I got both with A Different World, and I think it turned out okay. As the storylines developed, so did the characters, which the cast and audience grew to love. Hardison, I loved that Dwayne was smart, and I loved that he was from Brooklyn, and I liked that math was his thing because it was my thing until they put letters in it. He was easy to love. He was a good guy. He had a good heart. Guy, I couldn't do a lot of things I did on that show without Charlie, Charnell Brown, who played Kimberly Reese, Cree, Kadeem, and Mary Alice, Letty Bostick. Because of them as actors, I was able to do and say all the things that I, as a person, totally disbelieve. But I understood Whitley, and I understood why she became what she was, and the journey that she had to go on. Wilbekin, Dwayne Wayne really reminded me of so many of my friends at Hampton. He's really cool, but he's really corny. He's so confident, but he's really insecure. You can't tell him he's not going to win, but there's a vulnerability to him as well. Whitley reminded me of a lot of the women that I grew up with in Cincinnati, and in Jack and Jill and women who attended Hampton. There were a lot of women who came from privilege, who were light-skinned, and who felt high and mighty. But there was also the struggle for Whitley to find her voice as a woman, and I thought that was very powerful. Duane and Whitley would eventually become one of television's most iconic couples, but the on-screen chemistry between Hardison and Guy was hard-fought. Initially hampered by a little crush, Hardison says he had on Guy. "Guy, I think I was walking into the pit, and he just kept eating his ice cream. I was like, when I walk into the room, you better look at me. We had to build this up to a reality. I said, do you know the term sexual tension? And he didn't. Hardison, she was like, let's flip it. I'll be you, and you be me. And then it clicked. It was never the same after that. You felt like they were in love. Bowser, I love watching Duane and Whitley go from being awkward teenagers to more mature black people in love. We just hadn't seen that. To go from watching Duane relentlessly pursuing Denise to becoming this articulate, genuine, compassionate, caring guy who vies for Whitley's heart. And to see Whitley also mature past being this dilettante into someone who could actually allow herself to be loved by her soulmate, Duane. It just felt so real. Among the most memorable episodes were two consecutive shows that culminated with Whitley and Duane getting married during what was initially Whitley's wedding to Byron Douglas III, played by Joe Morton. Neither Hardison nor Guy thought the graduate-esque story was a good idea. Fales Hill, originally we had written it in a much more staid way, and everyone had a civilized, polite conversation about Whitley and Byron not working out. And then, I think it was Debbie and Joe who said, this needs to be the graduate. Duane shows up, it's all in the middle of the wedding, it's not deep, it's messy and crazy. Next photos, photo finish. Wardrobe designer Cece used Polaroids to create a visual timeline for the show. Lewis, Summer, Hardison, Guy, and Brown gather in a Radford Studios parking lot. Hardison, I was not a fan of that whole idea. I just thought we had done so much stuff that was grounded in reality, and this was a complete leap. And it felt like such a snake-in-the-grass thing to do to some other guy who you were friendly with. I 100% didn't buy it. Up until the last day before we shot it, I was asking the writers to please fix it. Guy, after we did the reading, I said, are y'all going to do that? That is whack. That is so corny. A compromise was made, and the writers added a scene where Duane tries to talk Whitley out of the marriage the night before. His grand gesture of interrupting the wedding stayed in the script, though. Hardison, I was doing the vows, and I messed up, and I panicked. I just said, baby, please. That wasn't Jasmine's cue, and I know what a boss she is, what a pro she is. She was going to wait for her cue, but I wasn't going to get it. I was like, baby, please. The second please was a please for her. Say your line, because I'm out right now, and this is just going to get worse and worse if we have to do more takes. And she said, I do, I will. We kept going with the scene, and Debbie said, got it, moving on. One take. In the show's fourth season, Cece was tapped as the lead costume designer. She would go on to create some of the show's most recognizable looks, from Freddie's texture-heavy boho ensembles to Whitley's polished suits. Cece, I remember standing in my living room watching A Different World and saying, I'm going to do that show. Not even a week later, the show's tailor contacted a mutual friend who was a costumer and said, girl, they're looking for a new costume designer on A Different World. Summer, I effing live for wardrobe, and Cece was heaven on earth. Wardrobe was my room. Freddie was wearing oxblood Doc Martens laced up to the knee, fishbone t-shirts, Frank Zappa t-shirts. I remember wearing moccasins that I brought from home. Because I had a character that didn't give an F about what other people thought, I really got to explore. Guy, Cece had Whitley down. When you're a costume designer, when you're doing makeup and hair, you're part of creating this character. You've read the scripts. You understand the character dynamics. Cece, shows, and particularly black shows, didn't really have an enormous budget, so I always had to be creative with Whitley to make her wardrobe look opulent. It wasn't like she was wearing YSL or Gucci. While Hardison wasn't a fan of Dwayne's colorful style, early on the wardrobe department gave him free rein to order sneakers from Nike. When Cece arrived, however, he asked if he could retire Dwayne's signature flip-up glasses. Cece, I didn't like them either, quite frankly. I thought that they were very corny. It was a battle that I had to wage, and ultimately, we won. The network thought that was part of his image, and they were very reluctant to change it. But I thought that he could evolve into something else, and he did. He became more sophisticated throughout the years, and his look needed to reflect that. When the show wrapped, Hardison was given one of the two pairs of Dwayne's glasses from the set. In a move he now regrets, he donated them to a charity auction. What charity, he can't recall. Hardison, that was stupid, but Joanne Curley Kerner, she was one of our producers, and she has the other pair. She said I can have them, because I want to send them to the National Museum of African American History in D.C. That's where they should be. Not long after the show first aired, a litany of guests began appearing. Lewis, the supporting actors that came through our shows were just insane. Patti LaBelle, Gladys Knight, Ron O'Neill, Blair Underwood. I mean, the list just went on and on and on. My absolute favorite episode of my 5.5 years with that show was the Gladys Knight episode where I got to be a Pip. Fales Hill. There were a lot of black performers, especially of a certain generation, who wanted to be on the show because they loved what it was saying and what it was doing. Diane Carroll was my mother's best friend. She was like my second mom. So when we decided we wanted to meet Whitley's mother, and we knew we wanted Diane to play her, I literally drove up to her house in Beverly Hills and said, "You need to come do this show." Alan, Patti LaBelle and I are friends from my early dance days in New York. She was singing, I was dancing. She was a big fan of A Different World, and she said, "Debbie, you got to put me on the show. I want to be on the show." I was like, "Patty, it's done." I think it was Susan who said, "We're going to make her Dwayne Wayne's mama." That was everything, because we already had Diane Carroll. Pitting them against one another, you don't have to do much. Just point the camera. Fales Hill. The first time Diane came to do the show, she gathered everybody, and she said that when she had started on a soundstage in Los Angeles, there was absolutely no one of color except for her. She said, "Look around. Your director is black. Your writers are black. This didn't exist before. You need to really honor that." Fales Hill. When Halle Berry did the show, she was not yet a star. She hadn't done any of her big movies. We cast her as Ron's girlfriend, and it was a one-shot deal. Then she became the Halle Berry we know now. With the success of the show came a level of fame that, while moderate in comparison to the visibility of young actors in today's more diverse, social media-fueled industry, was an adjustment for the cast. Bell, Lisa was on The Cosby Show, so she was accustomed to being in the atmosphere of a juggernaut. The rest of us, we were not. To have that kind of attention on you at 20-something years of age, it was different. Guy, my sister and I were out in Atlanta having beignet, and she said, "I don't know why this girl keeps staring at me, but I'm about to cuss her out." Then we realized that I was being recognized. Hardison, towards the end of the first season, I was driving home, and I saw about 2 dozen kids on my lawn. I kept going, and I had the car phone at the time, so I called Glenn Turman's wife, who's a realtor. I was like, "Joanne, I got to find a new house." Summer, I wish that people got as excited about black television as they did for Cheers, which was right down the road from us, but I don't think we ever felt a real overwhelming sense of celebrity. Fales Hill, We were really a family with all that that implies. Sometimes you're getting along really well, and sometimes you're not, but you always love each other. Bell, I can't tell you how many parties Debbie hosted with all of us there. She was so effusive and welcoming. Summer, I met Lila Coy Moon, formerly known as Lisa Bonet, and we became soul sisters, and I became the godmother of Zoe. A different world really altered the molecules in my soul and my destiny. Jasmine and I, oh my God, when I think of the first time I met Jasmine, love at first sight. Guy, we had so much fun off camera that I only remember episodes based on what was going on in our lives during that time, and what people never saw was how funny everybody was. Of course, Sinbad, but Glenn Turman, Lou Myers, just a witty, savvy group of people. Bill, one of my favorite nights was the night that Magic Johnson broke the all-time assist record. There's a picture of myself, Kadeem, Eddie Murphy, and Magic Johnson at a party that was in People magazine. That was emblematic. That, to me, encapsulates the best of that time. Bowser, the cast, they were our peers. We worked together, we hung out together, we talked about life together. We all grew up together. Bill, Debbie Allen's husband, Norm Nixon, was playing for the Clippers during our second season. Debbie would go to games, and Kadeem and I would join. The Clippers were awful, so we could just walk right down and sit in the front row. Then Kadeem and I bought courtside seats. So for all the time that we were on a different world, we were like the Jack Nicholson of the Clippers. Allen, I used to cook for the cast and crew to keep that family feel. We were having a read-through at my home when it was announced when Magic Johnson had HIV. We were devastated. Juggling an increasingly demanding stand-up career and also looking to get into film, Sinbad left in season 4. Lewis and Bowser both left in season 5. While they didn't plan it, both landed at Hangin' with Mr. Cooper. Sinbad, I was doing a tour with Luther Vandross and Anita Baker. I was hosting Showtime at the Apollo, and I was doing A Different World. I was always on a plane going somewhere or driving somewhere. It was my decision to leave because I was working so much, doing too many things. I said, I can't cheat them. Lewis, it was my request to be let go. Originally, the show was about 3 women. By the time season 5 came, I think there were 14 people that were considered principals. Bowser, I just felt like emotionally and creatively it was time for me to go. Sometimes when you grow up in a certain place, you have to leave the nest to truly soar. Little did I know how truly tough and oppressive the world would be outside. The little insulated group at Carsey Werner and A Different World was such a female-friendly and black-friendly environment, and the world outside was racist and misogynist, to say the least. I'm not really one to suffer fools, so I became more determined to create my own work environment. That's what set me on the path to create Living Single. By season 6, Dwayne, Kimberly, Ron, and Whitley had all graduated from Hillman, and a new group of students joined the cast in main and recurring roles. Allen, Jada Pinkett auditioned for the young girl with AIDS in season 4. When she walked in that audition room, she said, I'm the next Debbie Allen. I was like, damn right. I said, we've got to put her on the show. Where did she come from? She's amazing. Vales Hill, we didn't have a character who was from the hood and wanted to address that experience. Jada was brand new to Hollywood, and she was just magnificent and magical and had an extraordinary story herself. Bumper Robinson, Dorian Haywood, I remember the Tupac episode in particular because he was super cool and had street cred, and my character was the church boy. I was like, damn, how can I be cool in this episode too? But I realized then how important my character was to show those sides, those layers of us as black people. Despite consistently high ratings, often number two behind The Cosby Show and sometimes number one, A Different World was never nominated for a Golden Globe. The show garnered just 3 Emmy nominations. Carol and Goldberg, both for Outstanding Guest Actress and Outstanding Technical Direction, and took home none. Fales Hill, I'm not somebody who beats her chest about oppression, but when you see the way certain white shows at the same time frame were assessed versus the way we were assessed, it had everything to do with color. Bowser, if I allow myself to feel slighted by the lack of recognition, it would be a very sad life. I wouldn't have been able to move forward, quite frankly. A Different World definitely should have been more lauded and acknowledged for its popularity and its contribution to society, but we were making a show for the people, not for the accolades. While filming season 6, NBC announced to the cast and crew that A Different World wouldn't be renewed for a 7th season. Alan, there were a lot of politics going on behind the scenes, and none of us will ever truly know all of it. Though I have to say, I witnessed a great deal of resentment towards Bill Cosby's power, and Marcy, and Tom. 6 years is a nice good run, but I didn't like how it ended. It went off the air unceremoniously. It was not nice, and it was very hurtful to my entire company. The cast, the writers, the producers, the cameramen. For us to go off the air so unceremoniously, I don't know. I'll let the powers that be. They'll live with that. Summer, I don't think the network really gave a shit about A Different World. You know when you just don't feel the love? If you're driving down the street, are there any posters for our show? Why aren't we on the cover of anything? Where's the PR? Where's the love? Fales Hill, the saddest part was getting letters from teachers and principals from public schools in underserved communities who were saying, without you on the air, I can't tell my kids that they can aspire to anything and go to college. Belle, if you watch the last episode when Whitley and Dwayne are getting ready to walk out of frame, Debbie ends the shot on my face. You can see Ron breaking down in tears. That was Daryl coming unglued because that was the last shot of the night, and it was over. That was it. Few television shows have an impact as enduring as A Different World. Bowser, applications to college and HBCUs in particular spiked exponentially as the result of the show. That's a huge reward. Who needs more validation than that? Hardison, I live for the moments at the gas station when a grandmother tells me her baby wanted to be an engineer, because of me. Belle, the cast was in Detroit on our way to do an interview at a radio station, and this woman saw us in the street and lost it. She started crying and shaking, and we were like, all right, honey, don't die on us. But she was like, you just don't understand. I'm a doctor now. I'm married to a lawyer. None of this was possible for me before I watched A Different World. I just didn't know it was a thing. It's remarkable to know that you can still have that kind of effect on someone 30-plus years after the fact. Bowser, sometimes when I get interviewed, people ask me, well, how do you write or create such iconic shows or iconic characters? And the truth is, you don't create iconic shows or iconic television or iconic characters. The audience decides what really lives with them, what really sticks with them.
Thank you.
Requiem for a Dream by Keith McNally. Of all my restaurants, Balthazar has been the hardest to watch suffer through the pandemic, but I have hope and my memories. Opening photo, locals at the Balthazar Bar. Apart from closing for repairs several years ago and a few days after 9/11, Balthazar has been open every day for the last 23 years, and then COVID hit. Six other restaurants of mine have shut their doors due to the pandemic, but none affected me as much as Balthazar's closing. The idea of a large, bustling restaurant such as Balthazar struggling for life is like watching an experienced swimmer drowning. I can't stomach it and prefer to remember my restaurant as it was when it opened 23 years ago. I first saw the Balthazar space one early Sunday morning in 1995. It was a rundown leather warehouse called Adar Leather. At the time, I was building a vodka bar two blocks away and had passed this worn-out storefront every day for 9 months without noticing it. That changed when I spotted a handwritten for rent sign on its shabby door. Adar Leather was a 12,000-square-foot space on two floors that, from what I could see through its unwashed windows, was packed with strips of leather. The store was so down at heel that it gave the impression of needing its 500,000 leather strips to patch together its declining business. I was struck by the corner location and storefront that seemed to stretch all the way to Harlem. I immediately saw its vast potential as a restaurant, and I jotted down the phone number into my small Filofax. The next day, I called the landlord, and a month later, I signed a 15-year lease. As with all of my restaurants, my eagerness for the space died the second I signed the lease. Overnight, its location, one block from Soho, felt like another borough, and the number of squealing rats on Crosby Street seemed to increase drastically the day after I signed for the space. Overall, it now felt like a god-awful location. I had come up with the notion for Balthazar 3 years earlier while living in Paris. Like most of the few good ideas I've had, this one came about accidentally. I was searching for antique curtains in Clignancourt's flea market when I stumbled across a photograph of a huge Edwardian bar. Behind the bar were shelves stacked 20 feet high with a magnificent display of liquor bottles. These bottles were flanked on either side by two towering statues of semi-naked women in a classically Greek style. I was so impressed that I said to hell with the antique curtains and bought this battered photo instead. I carried the sepia-tinged image with me for the next 3 years, thinking that if I found a space with a sky-high ceiling, I'd build such a bar. Stepping into the tannery, I found that ceiling. Next photos, Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn at a book party in 1997. A seafood spread at a benefit honoring Donna Karen and Andy Cohen in 2009. The owner at the entrance to his opus. Paper napkins for customers to write down their numbers. The iconic red awning. Katie Holmes and Tom Cruise exit the Soho restaurant in 2008. Balthazar's signature pain de sigle. Actress Gwyneth Paltrow and director David Fincher at the after party for the premiere of The Game in 1997. Construction of Balthazar began in January 1996. The $2 million required to build the restaurant was provided by my new investor, Dick Robinson, the CEO of Scholastic Press. Once I took possession of the space, my first decision was to block out two huge windows on the building's side street. For most restaurateurs, dining room windows are sacrosanct, but when you like breaking rules as much as I do, you tend not to give a toss about convention. Anyway, I believe that restaurants, like plays and films, work best when they create their own world. Being exposed to the outside world while dining is like hearing the doorbell during sex. My co-designer, Ian McFeely, and I stared at my photo of the colossal Parisian bar, wondering where the bar should go, assuming, that is, we could build it. It took us 2 weeks to work out its location, but once we did, the rest of the floor plan fell quickly into place. Bars and the customers they attract give tremendous life to a restaurant, and where they are positioned is vital to their success. Ideally, a bar should have a strong identity separate from the dining room, but be seen or sensed from all corners. Ian also acted as general contractor. We never used architect's plans when building Balthazar. As ideas came, we simply scribbled crude drawings on whichever bits of paper were within reach. Whatever I might have saved on an architect's fees, I spent more on fixing my endless mistakes. But the formidable semi-naked female statues were another matter. Google had yet to be invented. Neither Ian nor I had any idea where we could find such vast statues, known as caryatids, or whether they could be found at all. Ian eventually suggested the 2 6-foot statues be carved by a classically trained sculptor friend of his, Brant Junceau, whose only question was a discomforting one. Did I know a woman with a voluptuous body and firm breast like those in the photo who was willing to model for him? Classically trained sculptors have all the fun. What I did next, I would never risk in these ardently prudish times, but I asked 2 waitresses from my vodka bar, Pravda, if they would like to model topless for the sculptor. Without batting an eyelid, they both agreed. The faces, bodies, and breast of the statues are a mix of the 2 waitresses. Which parts are from which woman, only the classically trained sculptor knows. While building Balthazar, I would occasionally have lunch at a restaurant called Jerry's on Prince Street. In the 90s, Jerry's was terrifically popular with New York's art crowd. One time, eating alone, I was approached by Jerry himself and given his unsolicited wisdom on Balthazar's chances of success. You're going to do 200 covers at lunch, but you'll struggle at dinner because no one goes there at night, he prophesied. Only someone brazen enough to call a restaurant after himself would presume to say such a thing. I've often been wrong about the success of other people's restaurants, but I've never had the gall to offer my opinion to the owner's face. In hindsight, however, I would much rather someone say this to my face, like Jerry did to me, than say it, as most restaurateurs do, myself included, behind the owner's back. 9 months into construction, I still didn't have a chef. In 1997, restaurateurs found their chefs through word of mouth. 3 months before opening, a good friend of mine, Pippa Cohen, told me of a reportedly brilliant chef, Riyad Nasser. When I first met Nasser, he was working at the prestigious 4-star restaurant Daniel. I thought Nasser seemed suspicious of me, but I always feel that with people I admire, and I admired Nasser from the get-go. Like good craftsmen, the chefs I respect most are those uninterested in the celebrity aspect of the job. That was how Riyad came across. Before the meeting ended, he suggested doing a tasting for me the following week. Nasser's food was incredible, and I immediately offered him the job. He agreed, but a week later, sheepishly told me he came with another sous chef from Daniel, his working partner, Lee Hansen. I was shocked, as this now meant I had to pay 2 salaries. Hansen's food was as good as Nasser's. I agreed to take him on, but half wondered if in the next few weeks there might be a 3rd, 4th, and 5th working partner of Nasser's I'd also have to hire. When I build a restaurant, I have a strong idea of what I want in terms of the design and food. As I'm neither a carpenter nor a chef, my job is to convey my ideas to the builders and chefs who are skilled enough to put it all together and, hopefully, take it to another level. A few years earlier, I directed 2 feature films, and was struck by how similar the roles of restaurateur and hair director were, and how dependent I was in both cases on people whose specific jobs were infinitely superior to mine. I felt guilty about this until I had a stroke 4 years ago. Being half paralyzed, I could finally recognize what a crucial role I played in the making of my restaurants and films. Just a pity it took a stroke to make me realize this. The only thing the chefs and I disagreed on was whether to put a hamburger on Baltazar's menu. Coming from a formal uptown restaurant, Nasser and Hansen were reluctant. For Baltazar to succeed, it had to appeal to people like me, who would be repelled by uptown starchiness. By stressing the casual downtown character of Baltazar, I convinced the two chefs to put hamburgers on the menu. Unintentionally, hamburgers quickly became our best-selling dish. The night before we opened, I took a final look at Baltazar and sank into a depression. The dining room looked effing terrible and hadn't come out the way I imagined it. It had been the same with the films I directed. I've always found it impossible to recreate something without making such serious compromises that the outcome falls far short of my original idea. Baltazar opened on April 21st, 1997. The response was staggering. Its 180 seats were full for breakfast, lunch, and dinner right from the start. Baltazar was a restaurant hurricane that caused a sensation in New York's cultural life. In the first 2 months, Baltazar was mentioned in three different television sitcoms, and New York Magazine published a map of the supposedly preferred tables of famous New Yorkers, half of whom had never been there. The publican press response was exhilarating for the floor staff, but a nightmare for the kitchen. Hansen and Nasser were often angry at me and argued that the absurdly high number of meals they had to cook was detrimental to the food's quality. They were right, of course, but when you're surfing the crest of a terrific wave, it's hard to think about the sharks lurking beneath. Toward the end of a 900-cover brunch, I'd see Nasser standing by the kitchen door, scowling, arms folded, counting how many people were still waiting to be seated. But he and our original crew of cooks did a remarkable job in those faraway, heady days. I'm forever thankful that Nasser coaxed me into hiring Hansen, as without him, Baltazar would never have survived the maelstrom. Nasser and Hansen remained at Baltazar for more than 15 years, and apart from 9/11, the restaurant's finances increased every year. An eternal pessimist, I believed Baltazar's success would not continue without them. For this reason, and because I enjoyed working with them, I offered the pair working partnerships in my next two restaurants, Pastis and Schiller's Liquor Bar. In 2009, I brought them in as full partners in Minetta Tavern. Over the years, I've noticed one unvarying trait in my customers. If offered a free drink once every 20 visits, they love the restaurant. But if offered a free drink 19 visits in a row, but not on their 20th visit, they're pissed off and resent the restaurant. I've since realized this holds true outside of restaurants. Productive partnerships between strong individuals often end contentiously, and my relationship with Nasser and Hansen was no exception. As always, the relationship broke up over money. They were both earning considerable salaries and profits from four of my restaurants, but when they asked for equity in Baltazar, I finally said no. Feeling aggrieved, they quit. 4 years later, the two of them opened the phenomenally successful Franchette. Sadly, since they left Baltazar, the three of us haven't spoken, which is a pity, as I'm very fond of Nasser, and I miss him terribly. He's also the godfather of my son, George. Fortunately, Baltazar continued to be as busy as ever. But nothing lasts forever, and Baltazar, like all restaurants, will ultimately go out of favor and close. A month after the opening, I was walking through Soho, feeling quite proud of Baltazar's success, when I overheard two women talking disparagingly about its food. Crushed, I uncharacteristically introduced myself and startled the two women by offering them a free dinner if they would agree to give Baltazar a second chance. They returned a week later and ordered a full meal, including wine and dessert. After they had wiped their plates clean, I unctuously approached their table, preparing to luxuriate in their compliments, when the shorter of the two piped up, "Thank you for dinner, Mr. McNally, but to be honest, we don't like the food any more than the last time. If anything, less so." My stroke paralyzed my right side. The pandemic paralyzed Baltazar. Donald Trump paralyzed the will of half the American people. Each of these dreadful incidents convinced me not to succumb to adversity, but to remember Dylan Thomas's lines, "Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Rage, rage." A vaccine for COVID has appeared. Trump has lost the election. And Baltazar was finally to reopen in January. The rage is over. For now, the light shines. Again, for now. Next photos, Karl Lagerfeld at a party in his honor in 2012. Baltazar's menu for the Raw Bar. Keith McNally with chefs Riyad Nasser and Lee Hansen the week of the restaurant's opening in April 1997. Isabella Rossellini speaks with Madonna at a 1997 party. A classically trained sculptor based the marble works on two Baltazar waitresses. Jay-Z celebrates the opening of one of his stores in 2009, and Victoria Beckham. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, Interval Selections by Mark Hoffman.